You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 177, The Future of Learning Platforms, Perspectives from LMS Vendors. That you get with the donuts. If I never get the donut, I just have a cup of coffee. And when I get to work, I like to have a cup of coffee, because I like to have a coffee when I'm talking on the phone. It usually goes cold, and I need to get another cup of coffee, and it's lunch, and I have an espresso.
Not morning anymore, so I have a Diet Cola and another Diet Cola, but then I'm feeling fine and I'm feeling pretty sharp.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That was a short clip from one of my favorite novelty tunes, Stress, from the highly caffeinated Jim Infantino of the band Jim's Big Ego. I met Jim when he was on tour in Philadelphia a couple of years ago. I think you'll really get a kick out of this song, so stay tuned for the full song at the end of the podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. This special audio podcast is a recording of a panel discussion at the U-Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference back in May. It was at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. Our keynote speaker, Phil Hill, was the moderator. The panel consists of Ken Chapman from D2L, Ryan McDonald from Blackboard, and Ben Moriarty from Strut Learning. You'll also hear some references to Glisser. That's the tool we use to solicit audience questions during the panel discussion. So, what are some of the questions that we asked our panelists? We asked them, what will be the most different about the LMS in 5 years? What will stay the same? Will instructional designers be more important than instructors? What hasn't worked regarding the effort to have data inform the LMS experience? What about the dark underbelly of data privacy and misuse of data? What hasn't worked with student personalization, and what will the future bring? What will be the impact of blockchain, voice control, machine learning, and other developments over the next couple of years? So without further ado, here's the full panel discussion. Hope you enjoy it.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and great meeting with people again. So one way to look at this session is I talked a little bit about the future of learning platforms this morning for the keynote. This is a chance to talk to people who actually have to do this for a living, so they can correct me, or we can find out where the disagreements are. But we really want to make this panel interactive as much as possible. So as we go through, I'll be monitoring as best I can for the Glisser questions as we go through. We have some broad questions that we'll be discussing. I will be looking at Glisser. But then at the end, we'll also open it up for general questions as well. But to get started, I'd like to start with, how would things look? Like, if you guys looked into the future, and when we say the future, let's say 5 years from now, how much will people recognize the primary LMS or learning platform of the future in higher education, keeping the scope there? Will they recognize it? How will it look the same as what they're used to today? What are the primary differences? So I'd like to get sort of that perspective and go around, and then we'll take it deeper. And we'll start with Ryan.
So I'm thinking back to a session that I sat in first thing today, where the University of the Sciences was talking about their shift from Blackboard's original experience to what we call our Ultra experience, which is our more contemporary user experience. And one of the comments that I remember hearing was, well, this actually didn't even feel like the same product. And so in some ways, I think what people know to be Blackboard, even today, isn't actually the full reality of what Blackboard is. So if you've only seen the original experience, the Ultra experience looks very different. So as we look 5 years into the future, I think for Blackboard, what we start to see is something that we, as a community of education technologists, have been talking about for a long time, right? The next generation digital learning environment. Phil did a nice job of describing why it's taken so long for us to get there. But I think the sort of tenets of that next generation digital learning environment, you're going to find us starting to really make some meaningful progress towards those connections of personalization, analytics, interoperability, et cetera. Analytics in particular, at our users conference last year, we announced something called Blackboard Data. And you heard Phil mention the importance of data in the future. And I think what's going to be very different as we look into the future, it's how much we end up using data and the extent to which data becomes a really integral part of the experience. And that doesn't necessarily mean we're just showing you a bunch of numbers. What it might actually mean is that the way that the experience looks and feels, it's shaped by those data in the background. So that's, I think, a key thing that we're looking at as we start to see the evolution.
Okay, great. Ben?
Yeah, sure. So I think the broad answer is no. And the reason I know that is sometimes when people look at our system, they don't recognize it as an LMS. I think that the way that students and faculty interact will be dramatically different in 5 years. And I think that'll be reflected within the platform itself. And I do think that the interoperability will be key towards how individual institutions actually compose that platform itself. So making sure that faculty have the ability to integrate a wide variety of tools and then have all the data elements they need be fed back into a central data lake and then have that data be used to essentially create unique and personalized experiences. Those things are not available today, and I think it's right around the corner.
Okay, around the corner. And Ken?
Yeah, it's hard not to answer flying cars for a question like this.
Yeah.
And 5 years ago, I probably would have said, it's going to look like a flying car.
Yeah.
It won't. I think it'll actually look materially similar to what people are experiencing today. If you look at the kind of the normal curve of how people adopt technology, you know, we'll see some really interesting stuff on the innovating and bleeding edge, but a lot more still bringing the level of sophistication up in online learning and real effective pedagogy in using online spaces and not, you know, putting the PowerPoint up there and a great book. I think that the evolution we're seeing starting to, and we're in that awkward teenage years, kind of the LMS in my view, it's still largely system driven. You know, it's the administration of the organization, the faculty themselves are what define and dictate that student experience. I think you'll start to see trajectories in the LMS space and in ed tech in general that are more learner-driven and that even start to move towards more intelligent-driven ways of representing a system and supporting learners and having their own experience and their own choice, as well as faculty and helping them understand what are some of the best practices for designing learning in an LMS and not using a tool.
Yep. All right. So what about a twist on this? What's going to look the same? Like if I log in 5 years from now, what will I say? Okay, I get this. We've been using this forever. Is it going to be the threaded discussion board that I'm a big fan of? Or what will look the most similar 5 years from now? Any of you?
I think what's going to look, I'll raise my hand.
Yeah.
I think what's going to look the most similar is what we see faculty putting into the environments. I think without more assistance at the vendor level to help bake in some practices and procedures to engineer and design learning effectively, you're still going to get people that are disconnected from their instructional design group, that don't have maybe the background and the experience to go and really stand up an effective online course. They'll be doing online learning, but maybe not really optimizing it.
Gotcha. Okay. Brian?
Yeah, I would agree with that statement too. And we're recognizing that's a bit of a gap in the market, right? So when you think about institutions trying to, you can have a great piece of technology, but if you don't have the faculty on board, if they aren't accustomed to knowing how to use the technology effectively, the technology means nothing, right? So we're trying to fill that gap with a number of different solutions. We have one called eTeacher that's all about building the capacity at your institution to help instructors who aren't necessarily familiar with online pedagogy. Maybe they're new to learning how to build courses. It actually is a certification program so that they can get really familiar with that. So I agree with that point. Beyond that, I think the other element, just thinking about what's student-driven, what's faculty-driven, once we start to really think about how data figures into the equation, we can start to see on the back end which elements of the learning management system are more used than others in ways that we can't today, right? So we can see that to some extent today, but even being able to do that at a much more sophisticated level. And I think that will drive the kind of innovation and decision-making that you see about where we put our energy when it comes to certain features and functionality. It's going to be data-driven, and it's going to be driven by data that relate to user behavior. And that's how it should be, right? Because the product should serve the needs of its users.
Sure. Ben, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think I agree completely that the types of content that'll be entered are really going to be dependent on how far that faculty is willing to go and innovate. And I think it speaks to that graph that you showed this morning, right? That chasm. How far can that 20% bring the rest of the faculty? And how much are the vendors willing to put in to make those tools to turn text into something that's easily digestible? I think if you look at, you know, enterprise as a whole, there are a lot of interesting tools in marketing, right? Like Lumen 5 is taking text and turning into really easy, chunkable videos. Amazon has a tool that's turning text into easily digestible audio. How quickly can us as vendors work to get these types of innovative tools into our platforms, make it really easy for instructional design teams and faculty teams to leverage those tools?
Yeah. I actually want to pull one of the questions out of Glisser that's related to the three of your answers right now. And this is a loaded question, so be careful. Does that mean that the designer will be more important than the professional instructor, given what we're talking about with the need for upping design? Yes. Answer yes or no on the record.
I don't think it's that simple. I think those are two sides of the same coin that need to be working and playing off each other. I think the process and the discipline of learning and establishing, you know, by maybe it's backwards design. You know, what are you trying to teach? What are the learning outcomes? How am I going to assess that? Those are things that the professor or the subject matter expert may not necessarily have, but they understand their students, they understand their materials. And in that teaming sort of concept, that's where really good quality online instruction is created. I think the challenge for vendors like us is that there are less feature and function and tool-oriented ways of presenting how you can design those types of experiences and how you know, instructional design teams and subject matter experts can work together and use their learning system in a way that's more natural conceptually to them and less of translate what I know and what I want to do with my students into discussions and quizzes and content type things.
Gotcha. What about you guys? The loaded question in particular, relative importance of designers versus instructors, including how they work together.
So before I came to Blackboard, first of all, I was a Blackboard client, and I oversaw a fairly large team of instructional designers, and this was in the relatively early days of online learning. And I can remember going in and having some of those initial conversations with faculty who had zero exposure to online learning, weren't interested in being part of it. We were sort of dragging them along. And I can remember those debates playing out and being caught in the middle of them. And that was a lot of fun. But I'm sure this is feeling very relevant to a lot of you. But where I think we eventually got to in those conversations was realizing what the instructional designer would bring is the expertise in how to formulate instruction for an online context or a blended context, whereas the faculty member brings their subject matter expertise in addition to a lot of thought about how something might work from an instructional perspective as well. And so I think, as Ken was mentioning, it's that back and forth that really ends up shaping a great course. And, you know, Phil, I think you mentioned design teams, right? So that notion of a cross-functional design team, that's how you get something that's winning. And that's where you're going to get really rich debate, dialogue. I mean, that is so much better than a course being designed in a silo by a faculty member who thinks they know everything, right? It's so much better when we get more perspectives into the room and we can have that interplay between designer and faculty member.
Ben?
Yeah, and that's how a lot of our current partners work. They have strong instructional design teams that work with the faculty hand in hand. And that's where the best courses come out. So I agree completely.
So everyone's bullish on the rise of design teams in terms of quality. And would you also say, and it will be happening more often in the future?
Yes.
All right. So let me call you guys on something. And it's plenty of hints from this morning. We talk about the importance of data. But as I was saying, I heard this 12 years ago. All right. What didn't work so far on having data truly integrating and informing the LMS experience, both for your company and for teachers? So why haven't we seen more actual data usage with LMSs so far? Start with Ben.
That's a loaded question.
Yeah, it is.
So I think one thing is that the feedback loop for data within the LMS structure so far has not been widely available, and it sounds like we're all planning on integrating that more deeply in the future. But for instance, if I'm watching a video on an external platform, how is that data being integrated back within the application itself? And I think ensuring that those lanes are clear between the consumption of content that's not directly in the LMS and how it's impacting the experience within the LMS is something that's really key. So from a technological perspective, making sure you have that clear routing and schemas between kind of that external tool and the LMS is really important.
Okay, but I want to... Yeah. But you didn't directly answer. Why hasn't it happened yet? Did nobody know this 5 or 10 years ago?
I think... Well, I'd love to hear one of these gentlemen answer.
Okay. All right, Ryan, you want to start? Why hasn't it happened?
So I'll speak for Blackboard. You know, when I think about your squid graphic, right, and that long trajectory that we've seen with, you know, Blackboard and its predecessors at kind of the beginning of this curve and then to the present, what's happened along the way is we have, you know, 1996 architecture that was self-hosted, managed, hosted in orientation, not built natively in the cloud. When you think about data in the context of the cloud, it's a whole other ballgame. And I think that's one of the key things that's shifted and why now it's different, because we actually have been able to convince more of our clients to say, hey, come with us on the journey to the cloud. It's going to be great. And when we get them there, they start to realize that having that connection to the cloud allows for the kind of interoperability and data transfer and the data lakes that Ben was mentioning before. You get that much more readily, and you can bring to life the kind of data-oriented, analytics-oriented vision that was in the next generation digital learning environment documentation back in 2015, right? Yeah. So I think what's changed is where the data lives. And with the data living in the cloud and more data living in the cloud, we can connect them because they live in the same place. And so it's different.
And just sort of for some context, and then we'll get to Ken. So the systems, like being in the cloud, I mean, Blackboard and Desire to Learn, but have migrated from enterprise architectures to cloud architectures at this point. D2L is almost exclusively in the cloud. Blackboard Learn, I think you're adding like 200, 250 clients a year moving to the cloud, and I think you're around 25%. So there's a massive industry move into a cloud architecture. So just to add some of that context. But going back to the question, why haven't we seen more data yet?
Yeah, I actually don't think it has to do with any technology barriers. I mean, the enterprise architecture and the horrors of doing extract, transform, and load of data are doable. I think it's a cultural problem, both of the vendors that have been working on trying to build the killer app. You know, there was the desire within our walls years ago to build the killer app. You know, what is the real turnkey learning analytics solution? And, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, that was all the conversations we were having with our customers. It was, you know, what do you guys do for learning analytics? And I think what we realized with that was that those were the wrong questions. Learning analytics isn't a thing in and of itself, at least in our mind. It's like electricity. You know, it's something to be plugged into an appliance. It's something that is a utility that should permeate the whole environment, the whole ecosystem to do some work for you. So what we found is what's changing the effectiveness of EdTech with respect to data is asking different questions. When we're hearing more sophistication in our customers for, I want to achieve the following things with respect to student success and student experience, in what ways can the LMS and the system of tools we have help to do that? That's a much better question than, what do you do for learning analytics? Yeah. And it's one where there's a shared vocabulary between the institution and the vendor, and it's one where you can iterate over a solution and you're measuring the same things.
Yep. Ben, did you hear what you wanted to hear from them?
I didn't want to say it because we haven't been around as long. So we were born on the cloud, but I tend to agree. Sometimes we'll get questions over, well, you know, what happens if a student presses play, pause, play? What will you do for us? And yeah. I think as we better understand what you know, institutions are looking to do with that data, we're going to be able to make more advanced decisions.
Okay. We have some interesting questions that the dark underbelly of data. So what about student awareness of corporate use of data, the misuse of data, privacy concerns? I guess one way to ask this question about, is that going to be a barrier to effective use of data in the future? And like, what are the main things to watch for? Like, what should people expect to see around misuse of data, privacy, and managing those areas? Start with Ken this time.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, most of the conversations that we get into there, I guess we don't have any nefarious goals around monetizing and data at this point, so it hasn't come up that much. But we have a ton of conversations with our customers about the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that their students have over the data that they're using. You know, what data are you looking at about me? Who else is looking at that? Why are you looking at it? What are you going to do with it? And what we've seen from institutions that have had more success in leveraging their student data, a lot of this is happening in Europe, we've seen, because of GDPR, and they've got a little bit of sophistication there. They're showing the students what they're looking at of their own data, and they're letting them see, this is what we see about you. That's a very explosive approach. I mean, because if the student doesn't like what they see and all of the other, you know, cognitive reactions they may have to that can be dangerous, but transparency is absolutely key there. I think when there's a perception of a black box and we don't know what people are doing, then your imagination is going to take over.
Gotcha. And GDPR, by the way, is Global Data Privacy Regulations. It's a European Union initiative, but it's got repercussions beyond there. Ben, so what about you? What are the big privacy, ethical, proper use of data concerns to watch for?
Yeah, so I think as varying underlying technology that feeds into the learning data lake proliferates, I think it's going to be critical that these applications have some of the similar behaviors and practices that every other application does. This application is going to send this level of data to, you know, your institution's data lake. So making sure that there is some interoperability of standards in terms of just verifying, you know, what an institution is going to do with that data. And then I agree, making sure that you're empowering that institution to be able to show that student, this is what we're collecting, this is what we're doing with your data.
Okay, Ryan?
So I think we have culture in our company where literally every employee has to go through compliance training, whether or not they're dealing with student data every single day. They have to go through compliance training to make sure whoever you are at the company, you are aware of your responsibility as far as it relates to student data. So I think just in terms of our corporate culture, that is something that everybody understands across Blackboard. Beyond that, when it comes to institutional data, when I'll put our mobile apps aside for a moment, but when you think about our institutional data, when it flows through the LMS, that data is the institution's data. And we are the stewards of it. So we are not the owners of those data. Those data are owned by the institution. And so I think being really clear and intentional about who we are in relationship to the data, I think that starts to allay some of the concern, is that once you can clarify that with the institution, I think that they understand it a bit more. So that's just what I would offer in terms of point of view.
Good. And I suspect we might have some follow-up questions at the end more about data. It seems like there's some real interest. But I have a similar question about personalization or focusing on the learner, especially given, let's start out with a jaded interpretation. The way it was first dealt with, we've known in education that we don't want to focus on the course. We want to focus on the learner. Well, the first wave of dealing with that was the vendors changed their nomenclature from course management system to learning management system and didn't work. Well, I wouldn't say they didn't worry. It was a marketing terminology thing from my perspective. All right. It's grown more important over time that we need to focus more on the learner. What have we learned about the past? Like, what hasn't worked with personalization, and what do you expect to see moving into the future around treating, centering things on the learner? And in this case, I'm going to go reverse again, start with Ryan.
You know, I think that there's a lot of opportunity when it comes to the relationship between personalization and data. So I'm not going to necessarily speak about roadmap things, but I'm going to speak more conceptually. When you think about all the data that you can have about a learner, you can start to not only give them direct information, data about you've been in the learning management system this number of times. And you can give them direct data like that, but then you can also give them data that maybe if we take our accessibility tool, Ally, right? You can take the same piece of content and it can manifest in multiple different formats. And that could be something that's text-based or something that's more video in nature, for example. If you have a solution like that, and you think about the data that's flowing on the back end, we might learn that a student really prefers one particular format over another. And so if they prefer one format, we might be able to serve up that format much more readily than we would know otherwise to do. So the environment, the learning environment itself starts to adapt to meet those unique needs of the learner. And we start to really take universal design for learning principles, and it's built into the very core of what the learning environment is, because those data are flowing in that way. So that is not necessarily on the roadmap. That's just kind of purely conceptual. But I think those are the kind of possibilities that open up when it comes to the relationship between data and personalization.
Right. Ben, I'd like to ask you the same question about why haven't we seen more learner-centric design, and what should we see in the future? And you might even give a little bit of perspective of your company, where you guys are coming from.
Yeah, so we are really focused on individual learners. We provide a series of opportunities for short feedback loops between a student and the underlying content. So the ability to have formatives built into the experience, the ability to have interaction discussion questions built into the experience where a faculty will pop up depending on how that learner is progressing through the content itself. Every single thing on our platform is aligned to outcomes. So learning objectives, concepts, topics, competencies. And so when we see that a student is struggling in a specific area, we're able to surface that concern up. And then based off that data, we're actually able to do things like automate email, to make sure that both the learner and the corresponding faculty member are being alerted so that they can come together and have a kind of discussion on the topic. I think your point this morning was really important. We're not trying to remove the learner from this equation in terms of decision making, and we're not trying to remove the faculty member from this equation in terms of decision making. Personalization has to be something where they are able to be self-directed, but we are able to guide them towards, you know, a better path, if you will.
Okay. And Kim?
I'm vibrating. This one's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, when we think about what the
It's just a panel.
I know. But we work in a great space. Okay. The premise of technology really is, for me, is to allow you to scale up capabilities that you have as a human being, whether it's a ladder reaching higher, or whether it's an LMS. You know, teachers and educators are great at connecting with individuals and personalizing. I mean, that's what instruction really at its core is. And one of the things that D2L was founded on was the Bloom's Two Sigma problem. You know, individuals that get one-on-one instruction do two standard deviations better than those that get classroom. So, you know, in our mind, the goal of the LMS is to help scale up practices that are impractical or impossible to do in a physical environment. So when you talked about UDL and Universal Design for Learning, that is absolutely fundamental to how we conceive of how a learning system online should operate. It's not practical for me as an instructor at the front of this room to give everybody here choice in the way that they interact with concepts, to give them freedom of expression and how they demonstrate knowledge, and to give them their own ability to engage with their peers and their learning environment. I can't do that as a single individual in a physical space, but I can design that into a learning management system. I can, at a fundamental level, look at how do I support those levels of choice in that model, and how I design learning and how I create those experiences. The barrier to that, I think we see again, is cultural. The transformation that really needs to happen with respect to personalization is the union of system change, you know, the culture, the enablement within your institutions. It's the pedagogy and how you actually want to design instruction and the experience. And it's the technology. And all of those things have to come together before you're going to get anything really transformative. Tech on its own won't do it.
So interesting question came in that I'm going to paraphrase it, but it's essentially saying if we're focusing more on the student and the student having agency and decision, is that in conflict with the push for accreditation standards and outcomes and predefining what the outcomes are? So does accreditation and the need to meet accreditation go against personalization, or do they work together? Anybody have thoughts on that?
I think they're necessary and critical to have together. You know, you mentioned having everything mapped to competencies or outcomes. That's one of the biggest barriers we find when working with institutions, is that it's a huge lift to map all of those things together. But the context that comes with that, and in terms of helping to personalize for an individual, you know, getting the insight from data to know what types of things are going to be sequenced best, those are absolutely necessary at that micro level for the individual, but they all roll up at the accreditation level. Yeah. So again, there's an organizational culture that's absolutely a necessity to do these things out of the gate.
Okay. Any views from you two on that?
I think there are ways to build in those accreditation standards into the platform and the systems itself. So I think, you know, we have something called dynamic nodes, which is a technical way of saying that you can really put whatever you want and tag it any way you want. But I think the ecosystem is the critical part. So if you do have kind of these interactions based on personalization tags, making sure that you are kind of bubbling up a certain level of interaction between a faculty and, say, a student is really critical. Making sure you have the ability to alert that faculty that they have a certain amount of time to respond. Those types of things are important in the overall ecosystem.
Yep. Ryan, any thoughts on accreditation? It's a fun subject.
It is a fun subject for anybody who's been part of one of those reviews before.
Yeah.
First of all, when you think about the kind of level that accreditors are looking at, right? So you have institutional accreditors and you've got programmatic accreditors. Institutional accreditors often are not kind of diving really, really deeply into the course itself. Programmatic accreditors more so. With that as just general context, I think with this move that we see around data, it's becoming really important, not only from an accreditation perspective, being able to serve up the right kind of data to be able to demonstrate efficacy to those accreditors, but then also it's really important in terms of how institutions are generally making decisions. So data becomes really important for that piece, for how the institution is making teaching and learning decisions, also resource decisions, faculty, that sort of thing. And then beyond that, it plays a role in the classroom in terms of how students are aware of their own behaviors that they may not otherwise be aware of, because suddenly they're looking at all these trends and they're saying, oh my goodness, I never knew that. I never realized that about myself. So I think that there are opportunities across that spectrum once you start collecting those data and using them to drive insights at each of those levels. So you drive insights that are relevant from an accreditation standpoint, insights that are relevant to institutional decision-making, and then insights that are relevant for faculty and students who are trying to make their way through a course.
Okay. So let's now look more towards the future and still keep in like a 5-year time horizon, because if you get 10-year, there's just so many unknowns. But let's talk about the new technologies and the things you read about a lot. So I'll mention three. but then I'd like each of you to sort of answer which one, or maybe there's an alternative, is most likely to have a real impact on learning platforms. So blockchain, voice assisted control, you know, Siri, Alexa, the follow-ons, machine learning, automated algorithms, and you can fit in some of the others. So which of the, this sounds pejorative, which of the...
I forgot the first one.
Blockchain. Which of those or some others, what are the gee whiz type of technology that is most likely to impact learning platforms within the next 5 years? And you can only pick one. So ready? Whoever's ready gets, go for it.
So my answer is machine learning. However, there is a really good EDUCAUSE report that came out that actually looks at the five-year time horizon, and all three of those are mentioned. So it's the Horizon report. If you haven't seen it, just came out a few months ago. With machine learning, I would say that the future is now to some extent, right? So if you think about one of our technologies that I mentioned before, Ally, which is our accessibility solution, there's a session immediately following this on Ally if you're interested. By the way, it's not just something that works with Blackboard Learn. It works with Soon, D2L, works with Canvas, works with Moodle. So it works with our OpenLMS product. But it actually runs in the background using some machine learning algorithms. So the future is now. And I think we're going to start to see more and more along those lines of machine learning, artificial intelligence. Even in that report that I was mentioning, they're seeing that pop happen before you start to see some of these other technologies pop.
Okay, Ben?
It's definitely machine learning. And I think as we look towards making sure that a myriad of applications can work with the LMS, it's going to be critical to have that ML piece that's going to be able to kind of sanitize all this data that's coming in and making sure that that data lake is bringing in sensible information and making kind of sensible assumptions on the student, the faculty, and its support system.
So cleaning up data so to give instance, you information? Is that what's
well,
the
so for instance, we have a product called Connect today, which works with a lot of different tools, but primarily it's working a lot with the SIS. When you get into flexible modalities like competency-based education, it can be really difficult to make sure that you are properly supporting the student within that SIS. So when terms end and the student hasn't mastered their final for a competency, what do you do with that data? Every single institution is going to have a different answer to that. So making sure that you have configuration over code is going to be really critical to scale.
Okay. All right. So Ken, and if you answer blockchain, you will have to explain blockchain. But go ahead.
Okay, then I'll do it through an asterisk. Yeah, machine learning. I think that one's obvious. I mean, that's another one of those areas where you're not, in my mind, you're not doing machine learning. It's a utility that's ubiquitous and you know will potentially inform any of the processes that you're evaluating as front end to educators themselves, back end to the administrators, or even operationally to LMS vendors. You know, we look at our hosting environments and we look at the utilization of our software. And we've got machine learning algorithms that help us understand the best way for us to support it, to make that support and operations efficient. So it permeates the whole setup. Asterisk, wouldn't blockchain, like a distributed reputation-based transcript, be an awesome flying car in 5 years? It would.
Yeah. Somebody mentioned in here it would be a flying minivan, not a flying car. So, yeah, it's a missed chance. So I know we will still keep looking at Glycer. I'd like to turn it to the audience to see if you guys have questions, and you can ask it of specific people or more broadly. So any general questions, anything you want to ask? Yes, get here first. So what is the biggest hurdle to adopting a different or a new element?
From feedback from people that you visit with or institutions that you see, what do you see as a large hurdle?
Any of you?
So I think much like any kind of decision that gets made at an institution, if you don't bring the faculty along, you're going to have a really tough time. So I think making sure that anytime you're bringing on some new education technology that really has a very broad impact, you're bringing the faculty along. And that EDUCAUSE report that I mentioned, the Horizon report, they talked about the barriers that would exist to education technology over the next 5 years or so. And one of the main things that they called out was those sorts of barriers that faculty can kind of put up that would keep you from being able to push some new education technology forward. So then I think it becomes a question of how do you work with partners like us to make sure that we can help you with those conversations. So at Blackboard, we talk about being a partner in change.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to...
Let's just deal with the barrier for right now, not the solution. We're all about barriers. All right. So all right. It's a good answer. All right. So anybody else want to chime in, whether it's faculty adoption or faculty buy-in, really, is what it's describing. What barriers do you guys see?
Yeah, I think it's important to differentiate between adoption and call it utilization or you know, effective use. It's easy to get adoption. People can dump a PowerPoint up there in a course shell. And oftentimes we see that count in stats. Oh, okay, I've got my faculty are adopting it. But that's not necessarily providing much for the student and really creating a quality experience. So I think that's one of the larger barriers. And again, my own experience and from what I've seen at D2L is those organizations that can articulate and those courses that can articulate, here's what I'm trying to teach, here are the learning outcomes, here are the skills, whatever you want to call it, those are the ones that get adopted or utilized most effectively.
Great. Anything, Ben, or...?
No, I think it's been said.
Okay, great. I had a question here.
With the new generation of learners that have shorter capacity to grasp information for any length of time, I think most people will probably agree it's about a 10 to 15 minute, you know, you can lock them in on something because they all think multitasking is real. And yet, what is your system going to allow us to do to provide those students, you know, sufficient material to address that issue? I mean, are you going to let us do things or have the ability to bring in, we're talking about the open garden mentality today. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you see coming? Or because a machine may not always interpret things the same way, you know, AI may do it differently.
Yeah. So how do you deal with different levels of attention span or keeping attention? How do you guys deal with that, or how important is that issue even?
I mean, from our perspective as a vendor, it's not about the specific content. I think it's about making it easy for a faculty that wants to find that engaging material to do that. If they've got a single search box within their LMS that they're building a course in, and it's looking across, you know, library systems and publisher stuff and open repositories and, God help us, Wikipedia. You know, to be able to find things from a central spot and not rely that you've got this tribal knowledge and you know of some site somewhere in your back pocket from someone down the hallway. In terms of actually getting the engaging experience, I mean, that's your guy's secret sauce in a lot of ways, right? We're sort of agnostic to that.
Yep. Ben?
Yeah, making sure that we're providing the tools to understand every granular level of the course and how students are progressing through, and making it easy to update that content to reflect how students want to behave. So we have adaptives and personalized lessons within our platform, and we provide really granular data on how students are progressing through. And we've already seen institutions completely overhaul some courses to make sure that they're appealing to that generation of learner.
Yep.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think I go back to instructional design best practices, and I think about microtized learning. So those bite-sized chunks, you know, that's how you go about eating the sandwiches in those bite-sized chunks, right? So part of it is, how do we, as your technology partners, how do we make sure that our ecosystems provide you with tools that can easily facilitate that chunking? So if I think about the Blackboard ecosystem today, we have a great partner that I remember using when I was a Blackboard client called Kaltura. Many of you might know it. They do videos. That's a video solution tool. And so I can remember when I was leading instructional design teams, creating microtized videos. We would take the long video, we'd segment it up, and suddenly what was, you know, could have been an hour-long video, but broken into those different segments using Kaltura, suddenly it's going to be received so much better by the learners who would be in that course. So I think it's the connection between instructional design best practices, thinking about that microtized learning, and then us making sure that in our ecosystems, we're able to support that kind of learning.
Because you asked the question, what happens if the AI gives the wrong recommendation? A practice we've seen pretty much across the board is put a human in between. The machine learning algorithm can make a recommendation, but it's the educator that needs to make a go, no go before it's seen by the student. And that's a product of the awkward teenage years we're in right now.
Yep. Great. I have time for at least one more question. Any other questions for them? So the question was about what processes do you each have in place to assess your platform and take those learnings to make improvements? Yes. Start with Ben.
We use, existing things that a lot of vendors do with Net Promoter Scores, but we also make sure that we're meeting with them on a monthly or bi-monthly basis and getting feedback at every turn. We also allow any member of the institution or partner's team to submit requests and problems directly to our representatives. And then we do a review each month, and we give updates on each individual request every single month.
Great. Ken?
It's a tough question to answer because there's so many different sort of perspectives, lenses you're looking at it in. You don't always want to turn around the feedback really quickly. You know, sometimes you hear what's being said on the surface, but you need to understand what the actual ask is. So sometimes you want to crawl or walk and not run. That said, for immediate type of feedback, we use an online community. So the users of our system itself tell us what's biting their ankles. And every week we do a review of what are the things that are biting everybody's ankles? And here's a quarter of our R&D team is knocking those off. We do a similar sort of approach at different time horizons. So there's a 90-day horizon we do that with. There's 6 months. And then there's the long-term thematic type things we're talking about for quite a while.
Great. Ryan?
Yeah, I think very similar. Our community site, community.blackboard.com, that's our front door for anybody who wants to share ideas or feedback with us, so that we can make sure we're incorporating that back into the product. In addition to that, we have a really great product design team that is always putting their ear to the ground when it comes to what our clients want, need, and we want to delight them, right? So when we started taking that product design mentality, I think it really started bringing about a seismic shift in the company in terms of how we respond to the kind of feedback that we hear. And we may not necessarily act on every single piece of feedback, because that is how we got ourselves as a company into trouble a number of years ago, where we ended up with bloated features, right? We tried to make everybody happy, right? And we just kept building, building, building. And what we actually had to do was to say, wait a second, let's try to figure out what are the most important things that we can be building, and let's focus on those. So you're going to hear simplification, simplification, simplification being an ongoing theme at Blackboard.
Great. And just to give feedback, even on the questions, for what it's worth, the most upvoted questions that were asked, and we dealt with both of them, one was on the data and student concern about misuse of data and corporate use of data. And then the second one was the question about, does this mean the designer is going to become more important than the instructor? So it's just interesting. And, those seem to be stuff that resonate on big questions.
I apologize for the sudden cutoff error. Lecture capture software cut us right off on time, and we did go a little bit over. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the panel discussion. Make sure to check out the show notes for links to the biographies of our panelists and moderator. Stay tuned for the full song, Stress. I think you'll get a real kick out of it. So until next time, have a great week.
The way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long, and I hang around like a bum. I think I'm going nowhere, and that makes me nervous. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright. Everybody's thinking about me. It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you when you weren't paying attention. It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you when you weren't paying attention. Trying to cut down on my caffeine consumption, so when I get up, I just have one cup of coffee, and I like to have another cup of coffee with my breakfast. And on the way to work, I like to get a cup of coffee, like the kind of cup of coffee that you get with the donuts. If I never get the donut, I just have the cup of coffee. And when I get to work, I like to have a cup of coffee, because I like to have coffee when I'm talking on the phone. It usually goes cold, and
only need to get another cup of coffee, and it's lunch, and I have an espresso. When I get back, it's not morning anymore, so I have a Diet Cola and another Diet Cola. But then I'm feeling fine, and I'm feeling pretty sharp, and I'm feeling pretty wired, and I'm getting things done. But right about 2, I get this little tiny migraine. It starts by my eyes, and it moves to the back of my neck, and it moves to the bottom of my spine. But it doesn't get there till 5 or 6 o'clock, which is the end of the day. So I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine. Except when I have to work late, when I have to work late, which I usually do. Addicted to stress, that's the way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long, and I hang around like a bum, and I think I'm going nowhere, and that makes me nervous. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's thinking about me. Hey, how you doing? Looking good. You been working out? Yeah, I can tell. Alright, see you later. I love to work, I love to roll, I love to play real hard. I love to steal little things from the grocery store, like a piece of bubble gum, or sometimes I just stick my thumb in a peach and leave it there. I love to work, I love to run, I love to water ski, snowboard, jet ski, skydive, parasail, hang glide, rollerblade, mountain bike, bungee jump. Well, I mean, I'd love to do these things if I ever had the time. I love to work, I love to work, I love to work out after work. I love to spend a little time with this one I'm seeing, except we never really get all the time to spend together, so we call each other up and we talk about work. But what I think I really love is to get up on myself on a little tiny island in the middle of the ocean with just me and a book and a cellular phone and a personal computer in case something came up. And I'd eat and I'd drink and I'd run and I'd sleep and I wouldn't do nothing except swim all day. So, you know, my beeper doesn't work underwater. Where are the sharks? Where are the sharks? Where are the sharks? And there's this kind of anemone that sticks in your foot and the poison goes up to your brain and you die. And say it, please. Say it, please. Actually, I think it'd be really relaxing. Just me by myself in the middle of the ocean. And that's what I really love to do more than anything else. Except I probably hate it. Take to distress, that's the way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long. And I hang around like a bum. I think I'm going nowhere and that makes me nervous. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's thinking about me, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's thinking about me, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.